This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Floodwaters from Hurricane Harvey still filled the streets in Texas when the next massive storm blew ashore in Florida. Irma devastated the U.S. Virgin Islands and other Caribbean nations before being downgraded to a Category 1 storm and now a tropical storm. It continues to batter Florida and Georgia today. Were these back-to-back disasters just a freak coincidence or a preview of a new, more deadly pattern that we may have to learn to live with? Susan Lozier joins us now. She's a professor of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Duke's Nicholas School of the Environment. She'll be participating at Duke this evening in a talk entitled Hurricane Harvey, the Science, Policy, and Business of Natural Disasters. Susan Lozier, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be here.
So let's talk about this because I think this is a real opportunity for us to talk about what we know, what we don't know for absolute certainty, but can rely on in terms of determining trends, and what this might mean for public policy. Let's talk about this question that people are asking about whether or not you can ever say that a particular storm can be attributed to what we know is a fact, this question of global warming.
That is a question, you're right, that everybody wants answered, but it's the question that's really difficult to answer. And so what I've been saying is that Harvey and Irma are the types of hurricanes we can expect as the climate continues to warm. But neither Harvey nor Irma can be directly attributed to climate change. That attribution is just really difficult to make.
It's not really what science does, right? I mean, if you're talking about trends, that's one form of calculation and a set of questions. And a particular event can't be equated. That's not part of the equation, is it?
That's true. But also the thing to keep in mind is that hurricanes are particularly rare events. And so that's part of the problem. And so if we want some confidence, and let's say statistical confidence, into these events and how they're changing in time, we need to have a lot of those events. And it's not, I mean, hurricanes have been happening, you know, forever, right? But the observable hurricanes have really been, you know, since we've been on this planet, but when scientists have been measuring, and we could say maybe over the past century, but some of those hurricanes came on shore and nobody was around to measure them. So our record of really having enough information about the hurricanes in terms of their intensity, et cetera, that reliable record might just be 50 years.
All right. But you talk about this being the kind of hurricane that we might see in the future, given the pattern. What is it about climate change and warming, temperatures warming, that might contribute to this kind of a pattern?
Well, the first thing is that we know that the ocean waters are really the fuel for hurricanes. And so the warmer the ocean waters, we expect hurricanes to be more intense. The other thing to keep in mind is that as the air is warmer, more water vapor can be held. And if more water vapor is being held, then we expect more precipitation. So in general, just given that we expect oceans to warm and we expect atmosphere to warm, as we move forward in time, we expect then the hurricanes to be more intense and have more what we call precipitable water, meaning they're going to produce more rainfall. Yeah. I will mention also that more intense storms mean stronger storm surge.
So stronger storm surge. More intensity, obviously more heat, that's more energy. And then, as you say, it's more warm water that can be brought into the storm, therefore more rain. How about more hurricanes? Do we know about the number of hurricanes?
So that is really not set right now because that initiation process is something that we're still trying to figure out the dynamics. So models have some disagreement about whether or not there will be more frequent hurricanes. But certainly once the hurricanes are formed, then they're being driven by, you know, the warm water, and they will have more rain. But the number, and that's also something that the statistics from the past 50 years, we can't really tell if there have been more or less.
Whenever the word uncertainty enters a conversation about climate change, that's where the confusion tends to spread a little bit. So we said that you're not going to pin a particular event on something called climate change, but we do know some things, don't we, or do we? For instance, let's talk about sea level rise. Are we more certain about its relationship with climate change?
Sure. I mean, a lot of people, you know, want to say these hurricanes are an indicator of climate change. And I always say we don't really need these hurricanes to tell us that climate change is happening. So certainly if we look at atmospheric temperatures, we know they've been increasing. We know that global sea level has been increasing. And we also know there's been a decline in Arctic sea ice. But you see, those measures are infinitely more easier for us to understand than hurricane dynamics, because we can measure the temperature whenever we want to. We can look at the sea ice loss, and we also, you know, can have global records of sea level. So it's really the fact that the hurricanes are so infrequent that makes it difficult for us to understand now what the trends are. But we do have the climate models that tell us what we should expect as climate continues to change.
And to go back to what you said earlier, just simple physics tells us that if you have a lot more warmer water, you can expect more intense and more wet hurricanes.
Yes,
that's
yes.
That's physics, right. The nature of physics. Talking to Susan, you can add something?
Well, I was just going to say one way to think about it in terms of like, well, why is there uncertainty? So if we think about all the hurricanes, let's say, that have occurred in the 20th century, and we know they're Category 1 through Category 5, and they've had different amounts of precipitation, and we put them in one big group. And then in another group, we put all the hurricanes that we expect to happen, let's say, in the decades ahead. And they're going to have varying amounts of intensity. Those two groups now have some overlap, right? So they're not a complete, they don't completely overlap. And in the overlapping area is really where Harvey and Irma are appearing. And so we have, it's possible that we had hurricanes like Harvey and Irma in the past, and it's possible we'll have them like in the future, but we expect hurricanes even more extreme than Harvey and Irma in decades ahead.
I'm talking now with Susan Lozier, who is a professor of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Duke University's Nicholas School of Environment. Of course, there are some policy questions that then get that we have to ask. I mean, as these hurricanes grow more destructive, we ask who should pay for the damage. And then there's cleanup, which is, of course, one part of it. But then we have to consider the cost of reducing our risks before they hit. And are our current policies reinforcing problems with flood and storm infrastructure? Martin Doyle is the director of the Water Policy Program and a professor of river science and policy at Duke's Nicholas School. He's going to be joining Susan Lozier this evening at Duke in that talk that's entitled Hurricane Harvey, the Science, Policy, and Business of Natural Disasters. Martin, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So tell us more about these questions. What kinds of policy questions, if we can expect a trend toward more intense, if not more frequent, more intense and wetter hurricanes. What does that mean for public policy?
Well, we ask people who live in flood-prone areas or areas that have seen floods before they have to have insurance for certain types of mortgages like federally backed mortgages. And so they are participants in the National Flood Insurance Program. And so to be a participant in that, they pay premiums. So there's that whole group of people that are in flood-prone areas paying premiums. When there's a disaster, the federal government is basically the insurance provider for them. There's a whole different group of people that don't have insurance and live in areas that possibly wouldn't have seen floods or wouldn't have seen disasters like this. And in those cases, we have the Federal Disaster Relief Fund, and that's what we're looking at, what was passed late last week by Congress and signed by President Trump. That put in about $15 billion for Hurricane Harvey. So we have these two pots of money. Both of them are very significant policy decisions at the federal level of how are we going to essentially provide federal support in the wake of natural disasters like Hurricane Harvey, Hurricane Irma, landslides, earthquakes, anything like that.
Well, yeah, that you're getting to another point because we had been talking about hurricanes and their intensity, but climate change also means more rain inland as well, and that means more flooding, and we're seeing more of that, right?
We are. I mean, it's similar to the hurricanes where we have incomplete records, so we're never quite sure if this is a cause of climate change. So we'll always be a scientist and hedge our bets, right? But we do expect, you know, more intense rainfall, and so it makes a lot of sense that we would see more intense floods. We would also see more intense floods in smaller and smaller streams, so not just the Mississippi River, but floods like the along the Eno River or something like that we would expect to see.
And this raises the question, when you have an insurance fund like this or a disaster fund, the question of moral hazard. I mean, are we living in places that have to constantly be replenished, and we know these are invulnerable places? What's the responsibility of the insurer to impose some kind of regulation?
Yeah, this has really been the Achilles heel of the National Flood Insurance Program. Well, there's two of them, so two heels. So first off, there are about 5 million homes that are insured by the Flood Insurance Program, but only about 40 to 50% of the homes that are in flood-prone areas actually have flood insurance on them. So we're only batting about 50%. The other problem that we have is what are called repetitive loss properties. And so these are the properties that get flooded The federal government provides the insurance, and the homeowners go back and rebuild exactly the way they were. And that's really the problem that we have, is a big chunk of the flood insurance is getting consumed by a small percentage of the ratepayers.
How would that change? I mean, what would be the public policy discussion around that?
The biggest one would be that there was talk about two strikes and you're out, or three strikes and you're out, about 10 to 20 years ago. It's really hard to enforce that. The other one, the big reality is that we need to impose fiscal discipline, that the premiums that we take in do not actually pay for the scale of the damages that we actually impose. And so what that means is that the U.S. Treasury comes in and backstops the flood insurance program. And that's really the biggest problem with the flood insurance program.
And when you talk about discipline, it's one thing to say, okay, this is the third time, we're not going to do it. But then when the pictures start hitting the media and the helicopters fly in, that's when the trouble starts.
Yeah, exactly. You know, without being too political, it's hard for fiscal conservatives to ride in on a helicopter with their sleeves rolled up and say, we're not going to backstop this. You know, this is exactly what we're talking about.
Well, it's easy for fiscal conservatives to do it if the state was, say, oh, New Jersey. But then when it's, oh, say, Texas, suddenly the song is in a different key.
Yeah, and this is where it gets really hard. It's always hard to be sure that your state's not going to be the next one that's going to be hit.
But in terms of moral hazard, I mean, it's kind of interesting because we haven't got 30 seconds for this, but insurance companies kind of do this. If I practice risky behavior, I'm going to pay more for my premium than people who don't, or at least I'll get a discount if I'm safer. Can the government do this, and do we at all?
We try to, but again, it's hard to impose both the fiscal discipline, but more importantly, the political discipline.
Martin Doyle directs the water policy program at Duke's Nicholas School of the Environment, also a professor of river science at the school. He'll be participating tonight, along with Susan Lozier, at a talk at Duke called Hurricane Harvey, the Science, Policy, and Business of Natural Disasters. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the State of Things, by the way, we've got more details on all of that research at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up, we're going to talk with a young woman who has the benefit of DACA and did not know when she was young that she was, in fact, undocumented. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.